Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, May 28, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call. Today we'll be discussing Tuesday's development in the Texas immigration case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the speaker on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome back Dr. John C. Eastman. He is the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service at the Chapman University School of Law. He's also the chairman of the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group Executive Committee, and he's a multiple repeat guest. I'm not sure how to say that, Professor Eastman, but we're happy to welcome you back and hear about the most recent developments in this important case. He's going to begin with opening remarks of some 10 to 15 minutes, and then, as always, we'll be looking to you for questions. Professor Eastman, go right ahead.
Thanks very much, Dean, and thanks again to the Federal Society for inviting me to participate in this wonderful forum, which allows us to get out hot news in a substantive way very quickly, and I'm just pleased to be part of the program. Of course, the big news out of yesterday, out of New Orleans and the Fifth Circuit, is a loss for the Obama administration yet again on its immigration actions. Let me set this up because it's a bit complicated on the procedural posture of the case, and I want to clarify what was decided yesterday and what not decided, just so people understand. So Texas and now 26 states have sued to stop the president's implementation of executive actions on immigration, the so-called DACA and DAPA programs, giving a lawful presence in the country and work authorizations to millions of people who are unlawfully present in the United States. The district court in South District of Texas earlier in the year issued a preliminary injunction of those actions and extended that injunction nationwide. What was at issue yesterday was the government's request to stay that injunction pending its appeal of that injunction. And the Fifth Circuit panel yesterday, a panel comprised of Jerry Smith, Jennifer Elrod, and Stephen Higginson, 2-1, rejected the government's request to stay the injunction. What we have now is a hearing on the injunction appeal that will be that's scheduled for July, and the government announced yesterday, or was reported in the news this morning, that they're going to now put their cards on that hearing, which is the formal appeal of the injunction. Now note, it's a preliminary injunction, so we still haven't really gotten to the substantive merits decisions of the case. We're at the preliminary stage, and the standards for the stay are pretty identical to the standards for the preliminary injunction, so it's hard to see how they expect they can win the preliminary injunction hearing, which is likely to be before the very same panel, although not guaranteed, but likely to be before the very same panel has just decided the stay motion and rejected it. All right, now, what was at issue? There are three issues the states have brought. One, that because the government's actions here amount to a substantive policy change, it required notice and hearing under the Administrative Procedures Act before it could be implemented. Second, even if they had done and met the requirements of the Administrative Procedures Act, there's no statutory authority for what the president has done here. And three, he also is violating his obligation under the Constitution's Take Care Clause, the clause that requires the president to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Technically, we have only the first issue, the Administrative Procedures Act issue, before us because it was on those grounds and those grounds alone that the district court decided the preliminary injunction, and therefore those were the only grounds technically at issue in the stay and also in the forthcoming appeal of that preliminary injunction. But the arguments in favor of notice and comment rulemaking under the Administrative Procedures Act dovetail pretty extensively the statutory and constitutional claims. So there's a lot of mix and a lot of kind of assumptions that can be drawn from the court opinions, both the district court opinion and the Fifth Circuit panel opinion, about where they stand on those statutory and constitutional issues as well. The argument that this is required under the Administrative Procedures Act turns in part on whether this is just an exercise of discretion, on prosecutorial discretion, or whether there is some substantive right being conveyed and altered. And here I think the Fifth Circuit did a very good job, as the district court had done, distinguishing between the prosecutorial discretion piece. The president doesn't have to prosecute, or by prosecute now in this context, I'm meaning put into removal proceedings every single immigrant who is subject to removal. That they can prioritize. This is a common feature of all law enforcement. The way I like to analogize it, imagine the highway patrol officer who watches somebody going 5 miles over the speed limit pass by and doesn't take any action against them. That's a vintage action of prosecutorial discretion. He has made the determination to prioritize the 20 over the speed limit lawless conduct versus the 5 mile over the speed limit lawless conduct. And that's vintage prosecutorial discretion. But the Fifth Circuit focused on the fact that that's not all that's at issue here. That even if you assume the whole categorical criteria for eligibility for the suspension of removal proceedings qualifies as prosecutorial discretion, the president's action here do much more. They actually confer a benefit, a lawful presence in the United States that makes them eligible for work authorization, for Social Security cards, for Medicare, for being able to file and claim 3 years of back Social Security eligibility, being able to file and claim 3 years back of earned income tax credits, which is just welfare payments. Those are substantial benefits that will flow from the government's decision not to institute removal proceedings here. And it's that providing of a lawful presence in the United States that confers a substantive benefit that makes this different than just choosing not to prosecute somebody. It's as if you say you're going 5 miles over the speed limit on my highway, and I'm going to give you a card that allows you to continue to do that until I revoke that card. That's different than prosecutorial discretion. That's conveying a substantive benefit. And it's that substantive benefit that makes this different in kind than the normal kind of deferential prosecutorial discretion case, for which the courts typically say we don't have any jurisdiction to consider the exercise of that discretion. And I will point out the difference between the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion by Stephen Higginson on this point is stark. Jerry Smith clarifies and elaborates on that point of distinction, which is crucial to understanding this case. Judge Higginson ignores it altogether, just pretends that the entire case turns on the government's decision not to implement removal proceedings against low-priority illegal immigrants without ever discussing the substantive benefits that are going to flow from that. Now, the other part of this case that is important and flows from that distinction is whether the states even have standing to challenge the discretion of the government in the first place. Normally, prosecutorial discretion things are not subject to judicial review, and the states don't have standing or anybody else have standing to bring those challenges. But it's because there's a conferral of the benefits that flow from this, quote, lawful presence that is given to the illegal immigrants who are put in this deferred removal status that allows them to seek benefits. Those benefits impose significant costs on Texas and the other states. So, for example, under federal law and under Texas law, the state is obligated to process a driver's license request from somebody who is lawfully present in the United States, somebody who has an I-94 number, which is what they're getting as a result of the president's actions here. That imposes about $130 per driver's license application cost on Texas, and with the number of the 500,000 or so illegal immigrants who are eligible for this program living in Texas, that's about a $50 to $70 million cost imposed on Texas as a result of the president's actions. And it's for that reason that the Fifth Circuit held that they had standing, or more precisely, that they were likely to have standing, because we're looking at likelihood of success on the merits here as the standard on this stay and this preliminary injunction. So that's kind of the real key points. But there are a couple of other things that I think are important. The court clarifies that this DAPA program that was adopted back in November of 2014 is, as I said earlier, more than just non-enforcement. It is, quote, an affirmative act of conferring lawful presence in the country and therefore eligibility for all these benefits. And then the Fifth Circuit went on to suggest that there is no legal authority to have done that at all, far beyond the Administrative Procedures Act rule and notice and hearing comment process, because the Immigration and Naturalization Act, the Fifth Circuit pointed out, sets out very specific criteria for who is eligible for exemptions from the general immigration removal process and who is eligible for work authorization. When those kind of criteria are set out specifically in the statute, the notion that the president himself has unilateral the ability to give exemptions even to people who do not meet that criteria kind of runs afoul of our general understanding of statutory rules. I've got a rule that says you're not eligible to be in this country, and as a result, you're not eligible to work in this country. Here are some very specific exemptions with detailed eligibility criteria. If you don't meet that eligibility criteria, you're not eligible to work. That precludes, as a matter of pure statutory construction, any authority of the president to give eligibility to people who don't meet those criteria. The Fifth Circuit calls it a very intricate process, and indeed it is. And I think that's very important foreshadowing of where the court will come down on the merits of that statutory authority and the fact that the president doesn't have it under the immigration thing. It even takes up with very specific terms some of the federal regulations and some of the intricate provisions of the federal statutes in the Immigration Naturalization Act that the administration has tried to pigeonhole their arguments on or latch onto as a basis for their arguments. And the court dispensed with them. It just doesn't lend itself to the kind of broad, unfettered discretion to give these benefits, this work authorization and all the other benefits, this status, this change in from an unlawful to a lawful presence in the United States that the president is doing unilaterally. So it's a very thorough opinion, about 40-some pages. It piggybacks nicely on the more than 130-page opinion by the district court, which was also extremely thorough and, I thought, thoughtful. And I think it bodes well for the ultimate success on the claims that have been brought by Texas and 26 additional states. And I think it's telling that the Department of Justice yesterday announced that they'll pursue the normal appeal rather than going en banc or even asking the Supreme Court to review the current decision. I think they know that they have dug themselves into a deep legal hole, and the courts are just not going to let them get out of it.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. In a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question today for Professor Eastman. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our callers, let me make the brief commercial announcement we often make. This is important. We've just added another call for this week's schedule. Tomorrow at 3 p.m., we'll be talking about Kellogg, Brown, and Root Services versus the U.S. That was a case that was decided on Monday by the Supreme Court. We styled it as the False Claims Act meets the Wartime Suspension of Limitations Act. It's an interesting case, and our call tomorrow will be at 3 p.m. Today, of course, we're talking to Professor Eastman about the recent development in the Texas immigration case. We've got three questions pending. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is Brad Clark, professor at George Washington Law School. I have a question about this case. I'm not 100% familiar, but are there any individuals? Are they as plaintiffs in this case, or is it all states? And I'm thinking of prospective employers who might employ aliens who receive the special dispensation from the president, who might be worried about legal jeopardy fines or penalties for violating immigration laws. And I wonder whether they would have standing to seek at least a declaratory judgment that they wouldn't have a penalty within the relevant statute of limitations if the president's action were to go forward.
Yeah, I think this one is only the states. I'm not aware of any other entities that sought to intervene as parties. So a lot of people that filed amicus briefs. There was another case following the DACA program that was brought by Border Patrol agents saying, we've got statutory duties here that you're telling us we can't fulfill. We're in a bit of a pickle. And that case led to a preliminary decision, but ultimately that decision was vacated with a holding that the Border Patrol agents had to pursue their claims through the Merit Systems Protection Board, which had exclusive jurisdiction over them. And then there was another case of, out of Georgia or Florida, if I recall correctly, brought by legal employees challenging the wage depressing effects of expanding the employment market with illegal immigrants. And I don't know what the status of that is, but I'm not aware of any suits by the employers themselves. But what you point out is, I think, a good alternative avenue for standing, because the statute's very clear. The employer can be civilly liable for employing an unauthorized alien. The president, if he is illegally giving out work authorizations, and then those employers hire them, they're still in violation of the statute. It's kind of a parallel thing with what's going on the Colorado and other states' issue of drug laws. The fact that Colorado has removed its criminal sanctions for the drug laws doesn't mean it's legal to market in drugs, and a bank that takes those deposits from the proceeds of that is still in violation of federal law. And so you've got something similar here, and I think that would be enough to give an employer standing to ask for a declaratory judgment. If I hire these guys, am I going to be civilly liable? And the right answer under the law should be, yes, you are going to be civilly liable, so you ought not to hire them.
Right. And I think just to follow up on that, the court, especially if the statute of limitations is longer than President Obama's term in office, the court could not grant a declaratory judgment in favor of the employer because they can't change the law any more than the president can.
Well, that's right. And even if the president says we're not going to prosecute it, that doesn't mean they're not subject to prosecution. Even this president could change his mind and bring the prosecution whenever he wanted. And so the fact that they've made a policy judgment not to bring the prosecution does not exonerate the illegal conduct. You see this in another parallel context on claims of Fifth Amendment refusal to testify. Well, I'm subject to the criminal prosecution. Well, they've already announced they're not going to prosecute you. Doesn't matter. I'm still subject to the law, and therefore I don't have to answer. It's a very similar thing.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to point that out because I think if someone wanted to have a backup case to ensure standing, that might be a potential case.
Yeah, no, that would be. Although I think in light of Massachusetts versus EPA, the Supreme Court case from a number of years ago now, where Massachusetts was able to stand in the shoes of its citizens to challenge harms that might flow 100 years from now by the rising of the seas because of global warming if the EPA didn't regulate carbon footprint gases. That the state was held to have standing there. I think Texas's claims of potential harms from the influx of illegal immigrants as a result of this action, plus the direct consequence of the more than $50 to $70 million in costs incurred for the processing of driver's license, I think gives the states clear standing to pursue this. I think the Fifth Circuit decision on that, as the district court's decision, is kind of bulletproof. I think they do a very good job going through that. The standing here, it seems to me, the direct harm is much more clear than it was in the Massachusetts versus EPA case.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for the good question, Professor.
Another commercial announcement. I wanted to let folks know, not with regard to Teleform, but a special conference we're hosting here in Washington, D.C. on June 18th. That's when we'll be hosting our third annual Executive Branch Review Conference at the Mayflower Hotel here in Washington, D.C. It's a day-long event, June 18th. We're adding speakers almost daily to this event. There's no cost to attend, and details can be found on the Federalist Society's website. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Professor Eastman. This is David Tryon in Cleveland. So this is a question about the district court. I'm not sure if you followed what's gone on after the injunction there, but as I recall, during the briefing schedule, the judge asked the government attorneys if any action had been done yet or if there any action was anticipated in the near future for purposes of an extension on briefing schedule. Government said no, we haven't done any of the granted any of this action yet. I'm not quite sure how to call it, but they said we haven't done any of this. We don't anticipate doing it for another month or two. And so the judge said, okay, well then I'll give you some more time to file your briefs. Well, lo and behold, after the fact, it was disclosed that that in fact the government had been doing granting this these special benefits to the immigrants and. So they basically misled the court, either they or their client misled the court. The judge was very upset and even wrote something in writing chastising them. And I was wondering if anything else had come out of that, if the judge had held anybody in contempt, or if there's any further discussion about that, if you know.
Well, so yeah, you're absolutely right. The judge set the hearing in February to be a couple of days before the government advised him both orally and in writing of when it would begin implementing the November DAPA program. And he did that to give everybody full opportunity to brief and consider the issues, very difficult issues in the case. And then 2.5 or 3 weeks after that hearing, the Justice Department filed a memo of clarification pointing out that that they had actually been implementing it from the very get-go and just hadn't informed the judge. And he asked, he said, I want to know what led to that memo. I want every copy. They had a hearing about it. He was unsatisfied with the hearing. He rescheduled it. He said, I want to know the metadata. I want to know everybody that touched that thing. I want to know the decision-making process. I want to know everybody involved in this thing. And he subsequently had a hearing on that, which I have not seen the transcript of yet. My understanding is that he chose not to issue sanctions, but I don't know that for certain. But quite frankly, the Department of Justice's conduct here was rather egregious, and I do hope something comes of it. When you've got the Department of Justice lawyers playing fast and loose with its representations to the court, the longstanding deference to the representations made by the Department of Justice that the courts have afforded for decades is called into question, and it's going to have serious ramifications much beyond this particular case if that becomes the norm in Department of Justice proceedings in the courts. We've got to rely on the Department of Justice lawyers to be at least as candid and, you know, hopefully even more candid than advocates normally in the courts of law, because they're not just representing a particular client advocating for a position. They are representing the justice system itself and all of us in the country, and we expect to hold them to the highest standards. That wasn't met here, and I hope some consequence falls from those misrepresentations. I don't think it has yet, and I'm not certain whether the judge has kept the prospect of that alive or whether he's decided not to pursue it. But this was rather egregious and something I think needs to be done.
Yeah, I agree, and I hope they do. Thanks.
Once again, if you have a question for Professor John Eastman, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending. Let's take another call now.
This is Jeff Dykes with Norton Rose Fulbright in Denver. The dissent by Higginson takes the majority to task for failing to recognize any distinction between lawful status and lawful presence. My first reaction on reading that was that this is hair splitting of a rather ethereal nature, but the opinion cites a couple of cases, 2013 cases from circuit level, that, as quoted at least, actually do make this distinction and say it's very important. C- Could you comment on this distinction between lawful status and lawful presence?
Yeah, I agree with your first assessment of it. It is hair splitting, and it's the Department of Justice trying to say we have not changed the status of people here because that requires an act of Congress. Trying to honor what President Obama said repeatedly in public forums, that he didn't have the legal authority to do what he's done. And so they create this kind of phony distinction between lawful status and lawful presence. As far as I can tell, the main difference now is lawful status means you have a right to this status. Lawful presence means you're lawfully present in the United States, but we can revoke it whenever we want. And so therefore, it's not conveyed on you an enforceable status right. But in any event, the majority does draw that distinction. It assumes for purposes of opinion that there is a distinction and that this is what we're talking about here is merely lawful presence rather than lawful status. And nevertheless, the lawful presence confers not just non-enforcement of removal rights or discretion by the government, but benefits. And as long as you are in that lawful presence, lawfully present in the United States, you are entitled to those benefits. And it's that entitlement to those benefits that flows from the lawful presence, even if it's not a permanent entitlement to those benefits that would have flowed from a lawful status, that's what creates a difference between the normal lack of jurisdiction over discretionary decisions and one that has changed the substantive rules. And so I think the majority opinion does clearly deal with it under the assumption that it's mere lawful presence and it still violates the president's authority here. Or that's the suggestion. Clearly, because it conferred substantive benefits, it's a substantive rule change that required notice and comment rulemaking under the Administrative Procedures Act. The dissent claims that they failed to appreciate the distinction, but in fact that's not true. They assumed that the government was correct that there is a distinction, but even under the lawful presence argument that they were making, their arguments failed.
Thank you.
Once again, if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We now have got three questions pending, but we've still got plenty of time left. Let's take another call.
Hi, Professor. This is John Fury at Center for Immigration Studies. I wanted to know what you think you will be seeing. We'll be seeing in July when we have the next hearing, and what type of hearings do you expect to see after that? How long do you see this going on for? What should we anticipate? I also have a question for the moderator. You mentioned the executive branch review event. Is that going to include any conversation about immigration? Because I noticed the website doesn't have a topic button dedicated to immigration. Thank you.
Professor Eastman, this is Dean. If I could go first,
Yes, sure.
We don't at this point have immigration on the agenda. The theme of this convention will be the role of the executive branch in policing the administrative state. So it might well be that's one topic of discussion, but it's not a focus, I would say. And again, that's June 18th at the Mayflower Hotel here in Washington D.C. And Professor Eastman, as you answer the question that was addressed to you, I wonder if you could tell us about the different legal standards for the review of a stay of a preliminary injunction versus an appeal of a preliminary injunction, if there is much of a difference.
Yeah, and let me also begin by saying, for those of you that haven't been to one of the executive branch conferences, it started off a few years ago fairly small, and it has become now on the order, not quite as big, but getting there, as big as the national convention in November every year. It's a first-rate program, and the Federal Society is to be commended on launching this additional program to their already large stock of programs. So let me go back again, and I've not had a chance to look at the Fifth Circuit rules on this. When there is such a large overlap between the preliminary motion that's decided by a motions panel, as we had here, a stay of the preliminary injunction order that was issued by the district court, and that gets assigned to the motions panel. And then when you get to the substantive issue that follows, oftentimes when there's such a significant overlap, just in the interest of allocation or preservation of judicial resources, you'll reassign it to the same panel. I know that's the rule in the Ninth Circuit. It's the rule in most circuits. I don't know for certain whether it's the rule or custom in the Fifth Circuit. I suspect it probably is. And since there's not just overlap, but virtual identical set of issues that will come up at the hearing in July, I would fully expect, if they have such a rule or custom, that the same panel will decide the appeal of the preliminary injunction that decided the stay of the preliminary injunction issue yesterday. And the standards of review are virtually identical. You know, you've got to show demonstrate a likelihood of success on the merits. You've got to have irreparable injury. You've got to have the balance of issues or the balance of concerns in your favor, what have you. And those are the exact same standards for issuing a preliminary injunction in the first place, and the same standards with an added dose of deference to the trial court on factual determinations, the same standards that apply to the Court of Appeals panel that is deciding the merits of the appeal of the preliminary injunction. All of this is still at the preliminary state. Now, let's assume that the Court of Appeals panel, whether this one or another one, upholds the preliminary injunction. Remember, it's still preliminary. We would then be back into the district court for further proceedings on the permanent injunction and the merits of the state claims, the APA claims, the statutory claims, and the constitutional claims against the government's actions here. It would be hard for me to imagine that District Judge Hainan or the Fifth Circuit panel that decided the case yesterday would reach a different conclusion on that ultimate merits question that it has reached preliminarily on the preliminary injunction or on the denial of the stay request, because they elaborated at length on the likelihood of success on the merits, and I think they're absolutely correct on the merits thing. They determined that there was no likelihood of success for the merits, having looked extensively at that merits question. And it's you know, sometimes after a preliminary injunction, there's a big fact-intensive dispute, and once you get all of the discovery and all that fact stuff out on the table, it alters the foundation for the legal conclusions. But I don't see any set of facts that are not already part of the record. There's not a real serious dispute on the facts. The government conceded, for example, that Texas is going to incur costs of $130 and change per driver's license, and there are going to be some half million illegal immigrants eligible for applying for driver's license in Texas as a result of this ruling. And so you could have had a fact dispute about that may have altered the legal analysis if the facts had proved to be otherwise, if Texas didn't have any costs or what have you. But those facts are all conceded. So I don't know how this thing is going to change at the end of the day. We'll have some discovery. We'll have another hearing, probably summary judgment in the district court. My guess is, since the stuff is so well developed already, that will happen late summer, fall. We'll have that ruling on the merits by the district court before the end of the year, and an appeal of that early next year. So I don't see how the outcome comes out differently unless you radically change something that just doesn't look like there's an opportunity to radically change at the moment.
Let me ask just a quick follow-up question there, Professor Eastman. I take it that a request for a cert petition on a stay of a denial of stay for a preliminary injunction would be an unusual move. Were you surprised, given the stakes here, that there wasn't a cert request?
You have to look at the odds. It would not only be unusual. I'm not aware. I mean, I'm sure there probably was one or two in history, but you know, a cert petition from a preliminary injunction is a rare thing. A cert petition from a denial of a stay of a preliminary injunction while the appeal of the preliminary injunction is still pending is in my understanding, unheard of. So the odds that they would get that granted is so slim that they may have thought it not worth the candle. And in a big high-profile case like this, when you ask the Supreme Court for cert and they deny it, however many times the Supreme Court tells us that a denial of cert doesn't say anything about the merits of the case, it would look like a huge loss to the Department of Justice, and they may have decided that they did not want to risk that they'll play the normal course.
And I take it with this follow-on hearing in July, in any event, July 6th, I think early July, that the briefing couldn't even be done on the cert petition. But let's turn back to the audience now. If you want to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending.
Thank you. This is George Lanou. What is the implication from the Fifth Circuit's ruling and the previous district court ruling on the status of the earlier DACA administration eligibility and the group of persons who were actually processed that was before the district court ruled and have now been discovered? What status do they have in the United States?
Yeah, I think the status is very tenuous. In my reading of these opinions, there is nothing in the holdings here that aren't as applicable to the 2012 DACA program, that's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, as they are to the 2014 DAPA program, the Deferred Action for Parents of those Childhood Arrivals. The legal arguments are identical. Now, the court said the only thing we have before us is the DAPA program, but I think it calls into serious question all of not the deferrals of deportation. Neither of the opinions really confronted the categorical nature of those deferrals and whether that exceeded the scope of prosecutorial discretion. But by focusing on the benefits that are obtained once you're in that deferral lawful presence status, it's hard to describe it without using the word status. once you're in that, you've got benefits that exceed what is statutorily authorized, and that's true under DAPA, but it's equally true under DACA, and it's also true under the parts of the 2014 DAPA program which changed the deferral status from 2 years to 3 years, and that's what was implemented in those intervening months when the Department of Justice was saying the DAPA program wasn't being implemented. It was that part of it, the extension of the DACA deferral status from 2 years to 3 years. And so I don't see any difference. And that means, quite frankly, an employer hiring either a DAPA work recipient, that's under the injunction now, or a DACA work recipient, which is not under the injunction, but is still in violation of the statutes because they're not eligible to work, I think that employer would be subjecting themselves to potential sanctions. The reasoning of these opinions suggests that the outcome in a challenge to the DACA program would reach the similar result.
May I follow up very briefly?
Yes.
If a state requires international students to pay out-of-state tuition, but has now decided that DACA students can pay in-state tuition, what's the implication here?
Well, yeah, I suppose a state can make that judgment on its own, although, with the Supreme Court's decision in United States versus Arizona with a very broad preemption, that would be encouraging immigration in violation of the statutory immigration rules. One would think that would be preempted by the federal law if it was properly applied. But beyond that, I think that decision of the Supreme Court in the Arizona case went too far on its preemption grounds. States ought to be able to make that decision if they want. But they ought not to pretend that it's based on the fact that they're now here lawfully present, because they're not. The president doesn't have the ability to change the legal rules on his own. The whole notion of prosecutorial discretion, which they're resting on for this decision not to institute removal proceedings, is that I'm just not going to enforce the law against you. But that doesn't give you this lawful status, this lawful presence. It doesn't give you the green card, it shouldn't, and there's no statutory eligibility, no statutory provision that says it can. And if the states are relying on the president's false claims there, I think they're doing so to their own disadvantage, and also kind of facilitating the undermining of the rule of law that's going on here. And I hope the states don't participate in that kind of pretextual ignoring of the law. We're at serious risk here of just wholeheartedly, unilaterally undermining the rule of law because some groups have decided they don't like the law that's on the books, but they've been unsuccessful politically in getting it changed. And the more you just start ignoring those legal rules, you know, people say, well, the system's broken, we've got to fix it, and so I'm going to take it in matters in my own. Well, the system may be broken, but it is still the system that's on the books and enforceable as a matter of law. And we've got certain mechanisms for changing the law in this country. And one of those mechanisms is not the president doing it unilaterally by a memo from his Secretary of Homeland Security. That's not the system of government we have in place. And, you know, we had this fight in the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee back in December. And Senator Dermott kept saying to me, you want to deport all 11 million people. I said, no, Senator, but it's you that has the authority. If you think our immigration rules are too stringent, it's Congress that has the authority to change it. What I don't find in the Constitution is the ability of the president unilaterally to change those rules, particularly in the context of immigration, where the Supreme Court has been very clear. Congress has plenary power here. I mean, the power over immigration is probably stronger than the Congress's power over most of the other items listed in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, at least as described by the Supreme Court. The notion that the president can just unilaterally change and set different directions on our immigration policy is a real affront to our separation of powers.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending. We've still got some time left.
Hi, this is Chris Bowen with Aaron Fox. Assuming that the panel in July eventually rules the same way that it's ruled regarding the emergency stay, do you think that the DOJ could get a different opinion either from the Fifth Circuit en banc or from the Supreme Court by the time that the current president has to leave office in January 2017?
Two aspects of that question. Is the timing going to be able to give any decision out? And I think the answer to that is yes. The second part of that is, will it be a different decision? And that one, I think, is a close call. The Fifth Circuit en banc is pretty evenly divided these days. I think it's a crapshoot whether an en banc decision would come out differently than this panel decision has or not. Similarly, I think the Supreme Court is very closely divided on this. If I were to make a prediction, though, I think the Supreme Court would affirm by a 5-4 vote the panel decision here. And I think they would focus, as the panel did and as the district court did, on the distinction between prosecutorial discretion for non-enforcement and no prosecutorial discretion to confer benefits. And I think that distinction is critically important, and it would allow them to say what the president has done here exceeded his authority without ever having to get into the very difficult line-drawing problem of how much prosecutorial discretion is permissible before you cross the line from case-by-case discretion to categorical suspension of the law. That's a very difficult line to judicially enforce, and I think that's why we don't find much of the discussion in the panel opinion here or even in the district court decision on that issue. The Supreme Court has in several cases said there is such a line, but you can imagine how difficult it is to enforce it. And I'll just to put it in context on the very precise facts here, the Secretary's memos sets out 5 or 6 criteria, eligibility criteria. To be eligible for the deferred action, you have to have these 5 or 6 things. And then they repeatedly use phrases like, and if you meet that eligibility criteria, then on a case-by-case basis, we'll exercise our discretion not to institute removal proceedings. And the Fifth Circuit and the District Court both rightly recognized that that was pretty disingenuous, that there's no case-by-case analysis. If you meet the criteria, you get the deferral. And as the district court said, it does not genuinely allow any discretion for those who meet the criteria. That language about case-by-case discretionary analysis after the pool of people who met the criteria is before you was merely pretext. And the president doubled down on that understanding with his public statements a month or two ago, say, in any line officer in the Immigration Services that doesn't exercise his discretion the way they've been ordered to would be flouting the direct orders of the commander-in-chief. And so there really isn't any discretion. The only people that are not getting the deferral are those that don't meet the eligibility criteria. Now, see, the reason that's important is because the language the Supreme Court has used is that you've got to have case-by-case exercise of discretion. And once you set out eligibility criteria and then you give the removal, the deferred status to anybody who meets the criteria, you're no longer applying case-by-case. You have categorically changed the substantive requirements of the law. And that's crossed the line from exercise of discretion to a suspension of the law. And that's what the court has routinely said is not permissible. Now, here's the difficulty, though. If that's where the line is, what if the Department of Justice or the Department of Homeland Security comes back and says, okay, instead of 100% of the people that have met that eligibility criteria, we're gonna only put 80% or 90% into deferral. Does that now qualify as enough case-by-case for you? And it's that aspect of it, where that line gets drawn, how shy of the categorical rule change is sufficient to get back into the proper box of prosecutorial discretion, are we going to allow? That's the impossible line to draw, and I think it's why, at the end of the day, the courts aren't going to be able to draw it. In this case, they don't need to, because you've got that second aspect. We're conferring benefits that have nothing to do with prosecutorial discretion, and it's those benefits that make this program illegal or in excess of the president's authority to implement. And I think that's where the Supreme Court will come down eventually when it gets there. And we could have a decision on that even if they go to the en banc route, but certainly if they bypass en banc, we could have it before be a bit of on a fast track, but we could have it by June of 2016.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes.
We do have another question pending. Before we go to the next caller, I don't know, Professor Eastman, how much time you spent with the Judge Higginson dissent, but did he get into standing? Obviously, I guess the majority opinion, the two judges found standing in order to reach their decision. Did Judge Higginson say much, if anything, about standing?
You know, I didn't finish the last 10 pages, so I don't know whether he took it up in that or not. But most of his opinion is focused on the lack of jurisdiction, and he's right. There's a healthy body of precedent, both in the Fifth Circuit and at the Supreme Court, that decisions not to enforce, not to prosecute, or to translate it to our current context, not to initiate removal proceedings, are discretionary and therefore not judicially reviewable. He did not cite the language in those very same Supreme Court cases that he was relying on that said, you know, in certain circumstances it crosses the line from discretion to categorical suspension of the laws, and those are judicially reviewable. And I think that's what's gone on here. But even if we assume that's not what's gone on, he doesn't take up at all the distinction between the non-removal discretion and the conferring of benefits, which is not an issue of prosecutorial discretion. And so I think his entire opinion, where he says that we had no jurisdiction to consider this thing, is wrong, because he doesn't take up the critical piece that does give them jurisdiction to consider it, and that is the conferral of benefits.
We've still got time for a couple more questions. We've got just one question pending. So if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Tripp DeMoss in Washington, D.C. So we've talked about standing, but even if the conferring of benefits presents a problem in the Supreme Court when they rule on this months or a year from now or whatever, said conferral of benefits outside the law violates APA statute, the INA, et cetera, they could theoretically not reach the issue of the program of non-removal, but that is still precluded from review by Cheney, right? I mean, Cheney says an agency decision not to prosecute. In Brennan's concurrence, he listed out, you know, four factors that would show when it crosses the line from suspension to suspension from non-removal. But, I mean, you can separate the conferral of the work authorization in DAPA and under Cheney, the non-removal provisions, you could find five votes probably on the court to say that would be non-reviewable, right? And so at the end of the day, the only thing that we can really get rid of is the work benefits, but they'll still be in some sort of unreviewable, I mean, you don't want to say status, but that's all we're left with, status, because under Cheney, it's just a blanket decision not to enforce, but it's essentially the same logic from Cheney. So they'd either have to refine Cheney, overrule Cheney, or do something along those lines to deal with the non-removal provisions in the DAPA order. Understanding of it.
Yeah, very good question. And I think Cheney has within it the caveats that help us decide this case, and there are two of them. One is Cheney itself recognizes the distinction between a case-by-case analysis, and that's why the OLC legal analysis and the Jay Johnson memo are all full of the case-by-case analysis language, what the district court called pretext, because it really is. You can't read that memo without seeing it as a mandate rather than a invitation for case-by-case analysis to the line officers in the immigration services. And Cheney recognizes that. If you don't have the case-by-case discretion, then you've categorically created an exemption from the law. You have suspended the law, and that is judicially reviewable. That's where the line gets crossed. Cheney says that. Several other Supreme Court cases say that. They didn't apply it in that case because it wasn't at issue. But the language of the opinion itself recognizes that distinction. My point earlier was, I think when you actually try and give effect to that distinction, it becomes a very hard thing to draw the line on how much you have before you've crossed that line into categorical suspension of the law. Now, there's a second aspect in Cheney, and this is the one that the district court dealing with the Border Patrol agent's lawsuit in his preliminary ruling before he determined that he didn't have jurisdiction because of the Merit System Protection Board exclusive jurisdiction provisions, he actually issued a ruling holding that because language used in the statute mandates the removal, if an immigration officer comes across somebody who is illegally present in the United States, they shall initiate removal proceedings. Language like that removes the ability to claim prosecutorial discretion to choose not to initiate removal proceedings. And that district judge held that that language in that context was a mandate which removed any discretion. Cheney recognizes that Congress can alter the ability to have prosecutorial discretion if it uses language that mandates enforcement rather than that just it conveys to the executive the normal discretion one has. Now, there are other cases that say you've got to have more than just the word shall. You've got to make very explicit that you intend 100% enforcement or what have you. But that aspect of it is recognized in Cheney as well. And both of those issues are not addressed in either of these court opinions. Both of them might, at some point in this litigation, become ripe for review and consideration by the court, but I don't think we're there yet.
Thank you.
We do now have two more questions pending. Let's take another call.
Good afternoon, Professor Easton. I really appreciate the thoughtful analysis you provided us here today. And following up on that last point that you made concerning the line crossing between case-by-case analysis and prosecutorial discretion versus suspension of the law, it would seem to me that, and this is my term entirely, it seems as though that the pretextual conclusion drawn by the majority almost relies on the idea that there was this talismanic recitation that Jay Johnson put into this memo, and in so doing, that's what largely carried the day in their analysis. But what Judge Higginson had highlighted, and I know that you had said you didn't get to the last 10 pages of his dissent, he seemed to focus on the aspects of competing affidavits, and that the failure of the district court to conduct an evidentiary hearing, taking testimony and directly challenging the conclusion that such claims were in fact disingenuous by DOJ and the executive, in claiming that they were, in fact, just case-by-case analysis, he seemed to think that that right there was something that would have warranted, at least from what I deduced, a vacatur of it and remand so that the district court could at least assess that. Now, on that procedural basis, how exposed do you think the majority opinion might actually be, and could that prove to be a lurking issue that could prove dispositive later on down the line?
Yeah, no, very, very good question. And let me explain what I think the district court did and why he didn't feel that these competing affidavits prevented him from issuing the preliminary injunction. The competing affidavits were talking at cross purposes. The government affidavits were talking about the number of people that had not been given the deferred action, and therefore it's not a categorical suspension of the law. But they were missing the point. The real issue is how many people who've met the eligibility criteria set out in the memo are not given deferred action. And on that, they did not dispute the state's affidavits that said nobody. they were trying to say some people didn't meet the eligibility criteria and therefore did not get deferred action. That begs the question of how many people did meet the eligibility criteria and were not given deferred action. If the answer to that is zero or close to zero, then we've got a categorical suspension or an altering of the eligibility requirements under the law. And that's what crosses the line that Cheney sets out. And there really wasn't any dispute in those affidavits on that issue. Now, I suppose the government could come back now looking at at the hole they've dug in and say, you know what, we better have a whole group of people that meet the eligibility criteria that we nevertheless put in removal proceedings to show that we're merely exercising our prosecutorial discretion in
right.
order to win this case down the road. They could do that. And after we get back to the district court where we're addressing it on the merits, if they come up with that kind of evidence, then I would think the states would lose on the first part of the prosecutorial discretion for the decision not to remove people. But I still think the states, no matter what, are going to win on the second piece, which is, but you don't get from not putting you into removal proceedings to lawful presence that entitles you to all these benefits. That's no exercise of prosecutorial discretion. That's a rewriting of the law and the benefits, and that there's no authority for under Article II's interpretation of how we get to prosecutorial discretion. And since that's where the main meat of this case is anyway, and that's what's provided Texas with the standing, and that's what's provided them with their concerns, at least the primary concerns, then I think at the end of the day the states win, even if the Department of Justice is able to show, you know what, we took to heart what you said, and we now are providing a real case-by-case analysis of the group of people who meet our eligibility criteria. And a good number of them are not put into deferred action, but are instead in removal proceedings and being deported. That would now put this back in prosecutorial discretion on that front piece. But again, not on the second piece. I don't see any way they win on that second piece under the law as it stands now.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Here now comes our final question.
Hi, this is Dave Hickman out in Washington State, and back to this drama at the district court. You know, the attorneys representing the Department of Justice have an independent duty of candor to the court. And when I've read the news articles on this, I'm wondering if they're not risking some sort of sanctions in their bar association. This may be outside your area of expertise, but do you have any thoughts on that?
I do. So there are a couple of things. Let me play devil's advocate in defense of them for a moment, and that is the judge was asking them, are you implementing DAPA? And I could interpret that to all of the new provisions for the parents of childhood arrivals, and no, I've not started implementing that. There's another part of DAPA that merely expanded the length of time in deferred action for the DACA recipients, and so that's really just a tweak on DACA. It's not really DAPA. And therefore, I haven't given you a misleading answer to your question. Right? So, now, that's just hyper-technical type of things that lawyer advocates do shamelessly all the time. We expect better out of the Department of Justice. But I don't think that's what the judge was asking, and I think they knew it, and they knew it because they sent a memo in 3 weeks after his decision trying to save their bacon, as it were, from the misrepresentations they know they'd been making all along. Now, the other explanation of that is the line lawyers who were doing the case didn't know that it was being implemented and been hidden from them. And after the fact, when they were told that, they felt obligated to bring it to the court's attention. That means somebody higher up knew what was going on and was misleading, but it wasn't the lawyers appearing in court. I don't think we know the answer to that. And like I said, I've not read the transcript of that second hearing on this to know, the details of what came out at that hearing. But somebody knew that program was being implemented and that there had been representations made by the Department of Justice to the court, both orally and in writing, that was not happening. Somebody knew that and did not come clean to the court until 3 weeks after the court issued its ruling. And I think if the court wants to pursue that, there's a thread there of misrepresentation conduct that ought to create a contempt of court, civil contempt at the very least, from that court. And I hope the judge pursues it because this kind of conduct in the courts by the Department of Justice ought not to go unanswered because it really does unravel the rule of law.
Okay, but the civil contempt, doesn't that just throw it right back in the lap of the Department of Justice?
Well, it does. It does. You've got it. It's same type of thing you have with the civil contempt in the IRS hearings over issued by Congress. It gets referred to the Department of Justice. The statute says they must bring the proceeding, and they're not doing it. So until you've got Congress in their oversight responsibility starting to threaten cutting off of funds, if they're not going to follow the law on this stuff, you really don't have any teeth in the legal requirements that are there until a new administration comes in.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there. We're out of our budgeted time, but we're also out of our questions. So, Professor Eastman, thank you so much for joining us, especially on such short notice. We appreciate your thoughts and the work you've done to prepare for this. So I also want to say I appreciate your complimentary remarks about the Federal Society and the programming it's trying to do for its members and for others. To our audience, thank you as well for dialing in. Certainly appreciate that. Thank you for your questions. A reminder to check the Federal Society's website for telephone conference calls that will be scheduled next week, responsive to Supreme Court decisions coming out. And our next scheduled call at this point is tomorrow at 3 p.m. We'll be talking about one such case decided this week, Kellogg Brown and Root Services versus the U.S. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Dean.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.